Welcome from Mount Vernon tonight, Dara.
Hi, I'm Dara and I'm an alcoholic.
Just there.
And welcome to the folks online as well. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. I want to thank Dale for asking me. And yes, it did take 2 hours to get here, but I've driven a lot further in the quest for alcohol. So, and I love being with fellow members of AA. So very excited to be here. And I grew up in a rural area and I love being in the country. So anytime I can get out, I live in Old Town Alexandria, which is too close to DC. But anytime I can get outside of stoplights, I'm a happy person. So a pleasure to be here with you tonight. When Dale said I would have an hour, I thought it would take 29 years and 24 days for me to tell you my story of my recovery, because each day has been that important to me. However, I will condense it to the Cliff Notes version and get done in 53 minutes. So, or five till seven, I think I was told. I grew up in, as I said, I was born in Philadelphia. It was in the 60s. It was at a time when there was a lot of turmoil in city. And my parents said, we're going to move to the country to get away from the turmoil that was going on in the city. And so we moved to a rural area and it was a safety thing. There was somebody I think that was peeping in my parents' house and they were worried that we weren't safe. And so we moved to the country and in Western Pennsylvania. And within about 9 months of moving there, I began to be abused by a neighbor. And that went on for 4 or 5 years. So the idea of moving us from somewhere safe, that somehow there was going to be somewhere else safe, it didn't work out that way. But in terms of, you know, my early childhood, being raised in a rural area, I liked in the sense that there was a lot of freedom. The nature was always very important to me. And so my life went on in my early childhood there. I'd say I was about 6 years old. Between the ages of six and 12 is when I had that experience of being abused. And you know what it did to me was it made me feel unsafe, and it affected my security. This would come into play later on when I did my fourth step, when I started to look at all the behaviors I was exhibiting in my life that I did to try to make myself safer. And all I did was make myself less safe. And, but that was one thing. The other thing is I was raised in a religious household. I was raised a Christian. My grandfather was an alcoholic. We used to laugh in my family because one of my grandfathers was an alcoholic and died of this disease. The other was a minister, and my brother grew up and became a minister, and I grew up and became an alcoholic. So, so there's something hereditary, I'm sure, in there, in that scenario. But I was raised in a very, in a Christian home. We went to church every week. But this whole thing that happened to me when I was a kid that I became unsafe during, the person that abused me looked like the picture of Jesus Christ that hangs on the wall. And that was another thing that affected my relationship with God. And it was the 70s now. We're now into the 70s. And the neighbors where we lived had a little statue of the face of Jesus in their window. And it was the 70s, remember? So it did something odd. When you walked by, the eyes followed you. And I remember as a kid being super scared when I got to their house because I had to pass their house to get to my house. And so I would get to the edge of that house and I would shut my eyes and I'd run real fast past the house because I didn't want to see, you know, that image following me. I think that's a very telling sign. I became afraid of God at a very early age, and I became afraid of people. And what that did was a couple of things. Number one, I learned how to lie, and I learned how to change who I was in front of people to make you like me, to make you accept me, to make myself feel comfortable. And that was and the other thing was I relied on myself more and more. The less I had people, adults that I could trust, the more I had, I was unable to trust the God of my understanding at that time, the God of my childhood, that I was counting solely on myself. And to the point where when I got into high school I was a straight A kid. I got straight A's. I was not a bad kid. I was straight A student. I played two sports. I was the president of the honor society. I was president of my class, all of these things, but it's all like me powered over. And this became a theme in my life. I became very self-sufficient. And to the point where, and I was in in high school, I was in a Christian rock band, and we used to go touring even. We would go touring around and to different churches and things. And then I went to college, and that stopped that. And when I went to college, I found John Barleycorn. And that became the next answer to any problem I had. And I found it very early on, probably the first week I was on campus, and I became the queen of parties. And unlike most people who partied on the weekend and studied during the week, I did that, but my weekends were longer than other people. I don't know how that happened, but I was partying on Thursdays and Tuesdays. And since nobody else was, I was sitting in the stairwell with a case of beer by myself drinking. And the resident advisors would have the signs on the wall, no kegs on the floor. You know, that I thought they meant no kegs on the floor. I put it up on the desk. I didn't know. I was a smart aleck, and I would read the rules to my liking. That was the next thing. I'm going to tell you a story about the character defects that I developed, some of them innocently to deal with some of the trauma that I had, but then they became out of control and misused throughout my life. In college, I kind of had a nervous breakdown. I was drinking a lot. This is still in my first year. I was drinking a lot. I was not going to school. I was depressed. And the school sent me to the health center, and they prescribed a very nice little pill. It was called Xanax. And I found that, you know, chased down with some NyQuil really helped me be able to be calm on the inside. And then that was a way that I would get to the weekends where I would drink and I would try to pretend like I was a normal 18-year-old. And this went on for quite some time. And I was really lucky to get through college. Somehow I was able to pull myself together enough to graduate. And when I pulled myself together and I graduated, I moved. I didn't have a job because, of course, people in college that are going somewhere actually do their resume before they graduate and they send it out places and they get a job. Not me. I moved back home because I didn't have a job. But that was apparent from the time I got home that I probably couldn't stay at home because I wasn't going to be able to live the way I wanted to live. And so I got a job down in at Bethesda, Maryland. So I moved down into the DC area That was 1989. And I thought I had arrived, because all my life I had studied, and I grew up poor, right? I grew up very poor, in the sense that in school I got free lunch because I was poor and my family didn't make enough money. That was another thing that I had to overcome. It was another thing that clouded me, the shame over being different than other people, right? At the beginning of class, when they'd say, you know, call your name, and you came up and got your lunch ticket from the teacher, as opposed to buying it. I internalized that, you know, that I was different, that I was, in high school, I stopped eating lunch because I didn't want to go up in front of the class and get that ticket. Mm-hmm. And I think back to that now, it's very sad, a sad situation, but those are the kinds of things that formed me, that formed this immature person inside and out into somebody that acted immature on the outside and became addicted to alcohol. And so I got a job here in the DC area. I thought I had arrived, because now I didn't have homework to do in the evening like I had it in college. I could just come home and I had no responsibilities, and they were paying me. I got a check every other week. And I was like, this is pretty cool. And so I would come home on the metro with my little briefcase. I didn't need a briefcase. I had one. I'd come home on the metro with my little briefcase, and I'd stop. There was a wine shop on the corner. I lived in Arlington. There was a wine shop on the corner, and I would stop in and I'd buy 2 bottles of wine, and I would go home, and my building faced another building. But if you sat in the right area, the reflection off the glass, you could see the planes land at National Airport. And I thought I was somebody, right? These are hollow things, right? I'm telling you the story of what I became from all of these experiences I had and all of these fears running wild by themselves. This is what I became. And I had a lot of friends, and I was fairly personable, and everybody wanted to go out with me because I was fun to go out with, I would be willing to do anything. I'd be willing to go anywhere. Everybody wanted to go out with me, but nobody wanted to come home with me, because when I got out and I was drinking, I became sullen. I became angry. I became cynical, and I became mean. And I was the person that we'd go out to a bar, and then while nobody was looking, I'd go out the back door. I'd never tell anybody I was leaving. I'd just go back. I'd just leave everybody. And I'd go to the next place on my own. That's the kind of person that I was. And inevitably what that led to was getting the phone call the next day. And you all can probably relate to this in your own stories. Is the dreaded phone would ring the next day, and the pickup would go something like this. Dara, we're really worried about you. You know, you're masochistic when you drink. And, you know, we think maybe you have a drinking problem. Now, this is what I heard. I heard that they had a problem with my drinking. And I just didn't want people in my life that had so many problems. And I made it, in my mind, what I heard was that they had a problem with my drinking. Not that I had a problem, that they had a problem. And it was kind of killing my buzz. And these kinds of things went on. I mean, one time, after I got home one night, I decided to paint my fingernails, and my roommate came in, thought I'd been stabbed because I passed out on the kitchen floor and spilled the red nail polish all over the floor. She thought I'd been stabbed, and it was just that I was drunk and doing my nails. These are kinds of things that I did. And eventually what happened is I got rid of all these pr- these friends with all these problems. Mm-hmm. And when I got rid of the last one, I thought, finally, I can be alone. Mm-hmm. And what I got was lonely. Mm-hmm. And the drinking increased, and it increased, and it increased. And finally, what happened for me, because, you know, we tell, you know, what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. For me, in hindsight, right, the rear view mirror of my life is the best look for me, because I can look back and see God's hand all through my life, carrying me, even in the darkest areas, right? Even in the darkest areas, I can see that. And I was working for a company, and it was moving. And you may or may not be familiar with the area, but it was moving from where it was to Calverton, Maryland. And I lived in Old Town Alexandria. And so it's about a 35-mile commute. And in the move, I was getting a new office mate, somebody that I really didn't know that well. And the first day that we got to the office, the new office, I walked in and she said, "Oh, we just need to rearrange our desks." And I said, I don't want to have my back. I don't have my back to the door, if it's okay. She goes, "Me neither. It's, you know, we'll work it out." And that was sort of the first sort of inkling that maybe we had some things in common. And then she disclosed to me that she had 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, "Wow, that is great for you." And that's really the way I felt about it too. I was like, you know, I wasn't negative about it, but I really didn't make, there was no connection to me with that statement. There was absolutely no connection. But in the following months of us being office mates together, I really declined in my drinking. I mean, my drinking was increasing, and I was a binge drinker, but the binges were getting longer. The times in between them were getting shorter. I was waking up in the middle of the night and needing to drink more. And one day, I was prone to crying a lot, you know, which, because my life was miserable. I was miserable. And I really didn't know what was wrong with me. And so anyway, I was driving home from work one day. I had a little Hyundai Excel hatchback. It was more like a golf cart, but that was the size of it, was small. And I wasn't a great driver, but I was driving home from work and I was crying. And I heard God's voice. Now, I say that having never heard God's voice before, but let me say it this way. I heard an audible voice in my tiny little golf cart car, and the audible voice said, "Go find the rock." And in an instant, I was immediately aware of this rock I had when I was a child. Now, I'll say this. Many of my friends in recovery who are dual addicted said they were glad God never told them to go find the rock, because they would have never made it to AA. But I didn't have that problem. And so, but the voice said, "Go find the rock." And this was probably in the October timeframe. And I heard, and then what my mind thought was, I need to find that rock that I had as a child. And I went home for Thanksgiving to my parents' house. And now that I had moved out, they had rearranged the house, right? The kids are gone. They've turned rooms that used to be yours into something else. But I started going through drawers, and I finally found the rock. This is the rock It was a rock that I had, and I think it was from a summer when, you know, when your parents, when I was growing up, parents didn't want their kids around, and they sent them to summer camp or vacation Bible school or something like that. This was, I believe, a vacation Bible school rock, and I found this rock in a drawer, and the rock says, "He said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me." And I remember I fell to my knees and I said, "I need therapy. I'm hearing voices and I'm looking for rocks and I am not a well person." I did not put any connection to alcohol or anything else. I simply said, "I need help." And when I got back to the office, that person who, you know, now we're into Christmas, right? Because that was Thanksgiving. And at Christmas, my office mate gave me a Christmas gift. And what she gave me was a 24-hour chip.
Wow.
And she became my first sponsor when I got sober. And she to this day, she said, "You know, Dara, I didn't know you had a problem with alcohol." She said, "When I was thinking about what to get you for Christmas," she said, "I just got led to get that for you." She said, "I had no idea that you had a problem with alcohol." And anyway, I remember getting that. And then I did things like I would go to the bookstore, right? Because I was like, "Let me read up on this, scope in advance and see if I have this thing." And I'd go to the self-help aisle and look for the books, you know, Under the Influence, and, you know, and I remember I'd be ducking down the hall, right? I'd be going down the row, and is anybody in that row before I go down there? Heaven forbid somebody see me in the self-help aisle. But I bought the book out Under the Influence, and I read it and I closed it and I said, "Oh, thank God that's not me." That's how much denial I was in. I didn't see myself in that book. And in the meantime, I had talked to my office mate, and I said, "You know, I think I need some therapy." And she goes, "I have a great therapist that I used to see, and she's right in Old Town where you live." And so she gave me the person's name, and I called her. I made an appointment. Unfortunately, the day I showed up for the appointment, I was actually feeling better. I didn't feel like that. You know, it's like when you schedule to get a haircut because your hair looks bad, and then the day you're going to get the haircut, your hair looks great and you don't want to get it cut. You know, it was that kind of a situation. And so I went anyway, and she was sitting across from me, and she was taking notes. And, you know, at some point she said, "Do you attend any 12-step programs?" And I said, "Are you asking me if I'm an alcoholic?" And she said, "No, I'm asking you if you attend any 12-step programs." And I said, "No." And she said, "Are you an alcoholic?" So she said, started to peg me very early on. But my answer to her was, "I don't think so. I don't think so," which sort of surprised me when I said it, because I would have never even hinted that I had a problem with alcohol. But I said, "I don't think so." 6 weeks later, I was laying on my living room floor with a bottle of Jack Daniels, and I was sobbing. I didn't know how I was going to live with it. I could no longer live with it, and I didn't know how I was going to live without it. And I was devastated. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who to call or anything. And finally, I went back to see her. I was seeing her once a week, and I said, "I think I have a problem." I said, "But you know, if you could just help me solve some of these problems I have in my life, I don't think I would drink as much." And she said, "You know, Dara, doing that is like trying to sew a button on without tying a knot in the end of the thread. Mm. You can sew all you want, but the button never stays on. And she said, what I believe is you need to get sober first. And then we'll work on the problems. And so I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on March 9th, 1994. Mm-hmm. It was at the old Independence Club, which was on Evergreen Lane in Annandale. And when I got there, I thought I had the bottle of Jack Daniels in the back seat just in case. But when I got there, I thought I was in the wrong place because these people were happy and I was not. So I thought I had made a wrong turn. But when I got there, they said, no, you're in the right place. Come sit down. And that began this wonderful journey. And there were great people there who looked out for me. Now, the meeting that I went to, which was, I went to two, but my home group was Nighthawks. And it was mostly men. It was mostly men. But those men saved my life. And there was a guy there in particular. He looked like Charles Manson. And his name was Slow Mike Purdy. And he was like a father to me. When I broke down at 4 months, he held me. And when guys would come up and give me their phone number, he'd come behind and take them right out of my hand. and he said, you know, I don't think he has your best interest at heart. And probably I didn't have any good interests either. And he probably didn't want to hurt my feelings. But there were also some really wonderful, wonderful guys there. In fact, in early sobriety, believe it or not, there was a guy there, his name, it was like a made up name. It wasn't his real name. Johnny Fire was his, what he went by. And we would get together and build a train, old like HO and N scale train buildings. And he had a platform and I had a platform at my house. And we would do that together and pass time and talk about AA. And those were some of my earliest memories of the program, was this wonderful, wonderful group of people who took me in and who taught me how to live, you know. And the very first thing they said was, you know, we need a candle person. We need a candle person for the candlelight meeting. We need somebody to light the candles at the candlelight meeting. Would you do it? At the time I smoked. So I think I felt important that they asked me, right? I thought, you know, they need me. They probably just needed my lighter, but they also knew that I needed to do service and that if I felt a part of, I would stay. And that is true. Feeling a part of is what I think kept me around. And I'll tell you, I would never miss that meeting. I'd be there with two lighters. I had a backup lighter just in case, because I didn't want to let anybody down. I was going to keep the flame going at the candlelight meeting. And you know, that was sort of the early time. I did make mistakes, right? I got a sponsor, which was great. You know, my sponsor was wonderful for me. And I told her, I said, you know, I don't really understand a lot. I was going to every meeting I could. I worked two jobs at the time. I worked a full-time job and I worked a part-time job in a toy store. But I was at a 7 a.m. meeting every morning in Georgetown. And then I was in a 10 o'clock meeting every night. And then after the 10 o'clock meeting, we would go out to a diner on Little River Turnpike, and we would have coffee till about, I'd say about midnight, 12:30. And then I'd drive home. I'd get home about 1 o'clock in the morning, and then I'd get up at 5:30 and I'd go to that meeting. And I did that every day. Wow. I didn't do it because I was a great AA-er. I did it because I was scared to death and I had no other options. And I was willing, if they had told me to walk walk to work on the beltway, down the middle of the beltway, I would have done it. I would have done anything they asked me to do. And that's just what it was. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for that desperation, because I think it's why I'm here now. I was not oppositional to anything that they said. When they said it, if they said jump, I said how high, because I really just was very afraid of being alone. And when I would get home at night after those coffee meetings and be about 1 o'clock in the morning, I lived in a high rise building. And when you got on the elevator, there was a button on the elevator that you would push if got stuck in the elevator. And the button would light up. If you pushed it, the button would light up. And the button said, help is on the way. And that became my mantra every night. I would come in to that elevator every night, because this is the first time I'm going to be alone during the day, from 12:30 till I wake up in the morning. And I would get on that elevator and I'd say, it's going to be okay, Dara, help is on the way. Help is on the way. And that was sort of my first slogan. And I went to literature meetings. I went to speakers meetings. I went to all night meetings. They had a lot of different things going on when I was newly sober, and I did it all. I didn't understand the literature very much at all. My sponsor bought me the book, The Velveteen Rabbit. She said, read this. This is the story of recovery. And it talks about being loved and becoming real. And it takes a long time and it hurts. It hurts to become real. She said, that's the story of recovery, Dara. I said, well, I'm hanging out with old timers. I want you to know I'm hanging out with old timers in the meeting, because I'm sure I'm going to find the answer to this. She said, oh, I can tell you the answer. It's a spiritual problem and it requires a spiritual solution. And she said, don't worry. It takes a long time and you have your whole life to work these steps, and you'll need your whole life to work these steps. And my first big book was The Velveteen Rabbit. I then moved up to children's books on the slogans. There was a store that carried these little children's books that were all those different slogans in the program. And I would read those. One was one day at a time. One day at a time is the best way to see that life's many changes occur naturally. Mm-hmm. The longest of journeys begins with one step, and the most beautiful gardens are carefully kept. That's the story of recovery. I haven't read that book in almost 30 years, but I remember it because I would read it over. I could not comprehend our literature. I went to the meetings and I tried to listen, but I didn't understand it. But those are my early things. And I read them so much that I incorporated them. And to this day, I still can pull them out, because it's true. You know, I get out of sobriety what I put into it. You know, my garden, if it's to be beautiful, has to be carefully kept. It means I have to do not the big things, not just the big things and the little things, a million things, the one thing that I don't want to do, you know, those are the things, right? That's what I've always thought about in sobriety. It's like, and I really didn't see this in myself till I sponsored people, because it's like, but when I sponsored people, then I saw it in myself and I said, yes, this was my story too. I wanted to do the things I was good at. But we're called to do the things that we're not good at. We're called to do the things that we don't want to do. And in doing those things, we get better. And we learn to love ourselves and we learn to love other people. I would be very remiss if I didn't talk about the steps in my life and the journey in these rooms through those steps to God and to myself. Because I think that's the true beauty of what we get here. You know, yes, we get fellowship. We get to come out and we get to meet people and we have something common. You know, we're wrecked in the same vessel, and we were on this lifeboat together, but we get far more than that when we work these steps. We don't just get the camaraderie, we get the freedom of the bondage of self. And I certainly have gotten that. My first step was done, not a paper pencil first step. I'm talking about, I know the moment that I did the first step. I was in a meeting, and my MO when I was in early recovery was, I'd come to the meeting and sit in the parking lot until 6:59 if the meeting started at 7. And I'd come in the door right before the meeting started, and I'd sit in the last row, and I'd put my head down. And you know, there's a meeting in Old Town that was, it's a speaker's meeting on Sunday nights at 8:30. And I was going to it, and I got there a little too late. There was no open seat in the last row. The only open seat was in the front row, right in front of the speaker. And so I had to go sit there. And when I sat down, the person told my story. And I can't tell you who the person was. You'd think something memorable like that I'd remember, but I can tell you what they said. They said they would stand in a crowded room against the wall and wonder why nobody knew what they were feeling like on the inside. I related to that so much, so much. And they talked about, it wasn't so much how much they drank, but the process in drinking, like what happened for them, you know, like me, I could leave my office in Calverton, Maryland, and I could say, you know what, Dara, let's not drink tonight. And do you know, in those 35 miles, I could not stop myself from turning into the 7-Eleven. I could not do it. I could not stop myself from doing it. And you know, that was the way I drank. And this person told a similar story. And you know, what would happen if somebody told your story? You know, what did I do with that information? What did I do? I went home and I poured myself a big glass of Jack Daniels. And I said, Dara, if you drink this, you're never going to stop. And I poured the bottle out. And that was my first step. That was the moment that I knew that alcohol was bigger than me. See, I always thought I could stop because I was a binge drinker. I could stop and then I would start again. And then I'd start lying and say, well, I didn't really want to stop. I'd change the rules on myself and things like that. So, you know, but this time I knew, I had a moment of knowledge to my innermost self, as it says in the book, that if I drank that, I was never going to stop. And that was my first step. And I poured it out and I kept going in this program. And then the other steps, you know, the thing with God, I was raised with a faith. I didn't have an objection to God. I thought I had done God wrong. I thought that God, you know, the whole thing that I had with the person that looked like God, that had abused me, all of that stuff, in time that all healed. What I saw in the second and third steps was this beautiful thing of like where it talks about coming to and coming to believe, you know, just the, you know, I used to leave my house in the morning and I'd be in the car and I'd say, oh, I forgot to pray. Oh no, I forgot to pray. Something terrible is going to happen to me because my sponsor told me I have to pray every morning. And you know, nothing bad happened to me. Prayer changed me. It didn't change God, you know. And I learned that in the rooms, that for me, praying was a way to connect with my higher power and to remember that I'm not God, you know. That was what prayer was for me. And I learned that, but it wasn't an overnight thing. It took a long time. I did my first fourth step when I had about 2 years of recovery. Now it's kind of a funny story. When I got sober, there was a guy that got sober 5 weeks ahead of me, right? And we would go to the same meeting. And he would share, you know, I'm on my second step. I'm on my, so he's one day he raised his hand. He's like, I'm working my fourth step. So I was like, okay, wait a second. Maybe I should be working my fourth step. So I went to my sponsor and I said, you know, I think I should be working my fourth step. This is what I said to my sponsor. How dumb. I said, you know, I think I should be working my fourth step. And she said, really? I said, yeah, I really do. I really think I should be working my fourth step. She said, why? Of course, I had no answer for that. I had no answer because, of course, I can't tell her because some other guy's doing his. That would sound dumb. I knew that would sound dumb. So I didn't say that. And she said, well, you know, as your sponsor, I think that you would be doing it for the wrong reasons. She didn't even know all this stuff. She just didn't want me driving the train, right? She was like, look, I'm watching over you. I've been through this. I know what's best. And the more I relied on my sponsor and less on my own kind of dumb ideas, the better my life got. I mean, and that's just the pure truth of it. And so, so that was early on that I wanted to do that. So now fast forward, now I have 2 years of sobriety. I'm sitting around the kitchen table with one of my best friends in the program. I highly encourage that. If you're new, get a best friend in the program, somebody that's got about the same amount of time that you can have some camaraderie with and grow up together. And they're still my friends 30 years later. I have two very best friends in the program. One's in Ireland right now, Ireland sober. And the other one's in California. And in fact, I was just talking to her in the parking lot and she said, I wish I was there. We used to have a lot of fun going to these meetings together. But we were sitting around the coffee table and I said, you know, she said, why do you think we haven't done our fourth steps? And I said, without thinking, which, you know, now this is the truth. I said, probably because it would make us change who we are. And that was it. That's when I knew. And I talked to my sponsor again. She's like, yep, you're ready for your fourth step. So I got busy doing that. I didn't have that wonderful euphoric. A lot of people have a very euphoric feeling when they do their fourth and fifth steps. I didn't really have that. I felt shame. I think it's a process, right? Some people have different experiences and they're all valuable. They're all valuable. I don't regret one thing I've done, one wrong term, one crooked path that I took, because it all led me here to a very wonderful place. But, you know, I didn't feel great, but I'll tell you, when I did my fifth step with my sponsor, what I did was, since we worked together, every day I'd come to work and I would tell her a little something that was on my fourth step. Every day I'd come and tell her a little something because I just was testing the waters. I didn't know. I'd never been through this before and I didn't want to just lay it all on at one time. And so, and she didn't seem to be bothered by it. But, you know, when I got to her house and she got out crackers and cheese, it was cute, and tea. And when I told her, when I said everything, now, granted, these are all things I've already told her. I've already told her these things. But when I told her all those things at one time, I cried through the whole thing, And she said to me, you know, Dara, doing the first five steps clears out a place inside of you for God to reside. That's the purpose of doing this. You're so bound up with all of you in here. There's no place for God to reside. And she said, you know, clearing all this stuff out, giving it to God, being entirely ready to let go of these things, this clears out a space for you to develop a relationship with God. And it was incredibly, incredibly true. But it took time. It took a lot of time. I've always been involved in service. I've always gone to a lot of meetings. I've been working the steps, but I still have relationships in my life that are strained. I never had a good relationship with my father. Never had a good relationship for whatever reason. There were lots of reasons. Lots of reasons and no good reasons. Let's say that. But we did not have a very good relationship. If I said this, geez, isn't it great? The sky's blue. What are you talking about? It's gray. You know, it was that kind of a relationship. I never really felt comfortable around him. But, you know, when I had just a little bit of time in the program, I got a phone call that he had a stroke. And I'm going to go back to my first year because this, and I'm going to leap forward till after my fourth step because it plays in there. It was in my first year and I got the phone call. And you know, I had to call somebody to ask them what I should do. I called my therapist. I said, my father had a stroke. What am I supposed to do? I did not know what I was supposed to do. She said, is there anything you want to say to him? I said, no, nothing I want to say to him. Okay. All right. He recovered. His behavior didn't change much. Mine changed probably a little, you know. Don't want to make myself sound like I was some perfect person or anything, because I wasn't. And it's much easier to have new relationships than it is to fix old ones. But the funny thing is, it meant just after I had done my sixth and seventh step, my father had a second stroke. And now this is many years later. This is eight years. And he had a second stroke and it was much worse. And you know, when I got that phone call, I didn't need anybody to tell me what I was supposed to do. And I didn't, it wasn't, you know, it's like that, the saying in the promises, you'll intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle you. These are living examples. And I can't point to one thing in my sobriety. That's why I said it would take me a long time to tell you everything, because all those little things led up to these moments. And so I went home. And the funniest thing is, I had the worst relationship of anybody in my family, the worst communicating relationship with my father of anybody. I was the only one that could understand him. Now, if God doesn't have a funny sense of humor, no, my father had a stroke that affected his speech, and nobody in the family could understand him except for me. And I heard him clear as a bell. And it was kind of just the most amazing thing. And although we didn't have that reconciliation moment of, you know, like you see in the movies, he had a very, very serious stroke and he was going to die. I didn't want him to suffer. That was the first time in my whole life I didn't want my dad to suffer. I used to plot how I was going to kill him. I used to plot how, you know, why couldn't something bad happen to him for all these bad things he had done to me? And here it was, this person that I didn't understand and who didn't understand me. And we had this strained relationship. In his final days, I was the only one that could understand him, and I didn't want him to suffer. And that to me is the AA story, right? That is, there, some of the stories don't have happy endings. They have beautiful endings. Beauty isn't always happy. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful ending to me. And he passed away in 2002, so 21 years ago. And that was what, yeah, that was just about when I had 7 or 8 years of sobriety. So, but what I learned from that is, everything happens in God's time in my life if I am doing the work that's required of me here. And I don't have to fuss and struggle and strife and all. I don't have to do that. I have to show up and I have to work and all that kind of stuff. But I don't get to choose the outcome. I get to choose my behavior. And the outcome is what the outcome is. I had heard a very wonderful thing at an AA meeting, an AA convention, and talking about the third step. And the person said, you know, I walk through life and I picture myself in God's hands and I picture my life in God's hands. And I say, God, you know, you can take anything you want. And you can put anything you want in there. Take it out and put it in, because my experience when I look backward in the rearview mirror is I got everything I needed when I needed it. And some of the things that I thought I wanted, I didn't really want at all. And that's really the experience that I had. You know, now I have a very beautiful life. I've worked all the steps. I work all the steps. I incorporate those steps into my life. I am able to, I do service. I do a lot of service. I sponsor people and I have a sponsor. And to me, these aren't commitments. I get to do them. These are things I get to do because I live a free life. And because of this, now I know who I am. You know, all that stuff that I got when I was little, all those fears and all those insecurities and all that unsafeness, I got in sobriety, I got all that back. I found security. I found security in a program. I found security in a higher power. I know who I am as a person, the good, the bad, and the ugly. You want to know what my character defects are? See me after the meeting. I'll tell you every one. I have a friend that said at some point in her sobriety, she realized she could drive down. If they put her whole life on a billboard, the good, bad, and the ugly, she wouldn't care who saw it. And, you know, that's what sobriety gives us. We get the ability to be who we are, and it's okay. And the more, you know, I used to get really stressed out about people in the HOV lane. That used to irritate me. I would watch, you know, I would get in the on the road and I would watch. When is the next person that doesn't have two people in their car going to be in that HOV lane? I was like the HOV police. And, you know, one day I realized I was in the HOV lane. It was an accident. Not everybody is trying to break the rules. And when I started to give other people a break, I was able to give myself a break. And when I was able to give myself a break, I was able to give other people a break. And that's been another gift of the program. And I'm gonna say this. I have a very wonderful life now. I didn't get all the things. I didn't get Boy Meets Girl on AA campus, unfortunately. Not yet. God's not finished yet, I guess. But I didn't get that story yet. All the things I thought I wanted. But I got a beautiful life, a very beautiful life. I know who I am. I know where I'm going. I live each life, each day, one day at a time. I found that I have interests and hobbies and things that I like to do. I've developed an interest in photography and I've gone really cool places. In fact, next month I'm going tornado chasing to take pictures of tornadoes. And that might not be so smart, but I mean, but it interests me and it's exhilarating and things like that. And I have the ability to do things and explore things that I was afraid to do before in the past. The fear, that kind of fear is gone. And I'll close with this, because I always say when I speak, I like to use a little of the literature in case you didn't get anything out of it. You're bound to get something out of this, because this is by far, always when I share my story, I always close with this. I think it's the most beautiful piece in our literature. It's out of the 12 and 12, step 12. But today in well-matured AAs, these distorted drives have been restored to something like their true purpose and direction. We no longer strive to dominate or rule those about us in order to gain self-importance. We no longer seek fame and honor in order to be praised. When by devoted service to family, friends, business, or community, we attract widespread affection and are sometimes singled out for posts of greater responsibility and trust, we try to be humbly grateful and exert ourselves the more in a spirit of love and service. True leadership, we find, depends upon able example and not upon vain displays of power or glory. Still more wonderful is the feeling that we do not have to be specially distinguished among our fellows in order to be useful and profoundly happy. Not many of us can be leaders of prominence, nor do we wish to be. Service gladly rendered, obligations squarely met, troubles well accepted or solved with God's help, the knowledge that at home or in the world outside, we are partners in a common effort. The well understood fact that in God's sight, all human beings are important. The proof that love freely given surely brings a full return. The certainty that we are no longer isolated and alone in self-constructed prisons. The surety that we need no longer be square pegs in round holes, but can fit and belong in God's scheme of things. These are the permanent and legitimate satisfactions of right living, for which no amount of pomp and circumstance, no heap of material possessions could possibly be substitutes. True ambition was not what we thought it was. True ambition is the deep desire to live usefully and walk humbly under the grace of God. These little studies of AA's 12 steps now come to a close. We've been considering so many problems that it may appear that AA consists mainly of racking dilemmas and troubleshooting. To a certain extent, that's true. We've been talking about problems because we are problem people who have found a way up and out and who wish to share our knowledge that way with all who can use it. For it is only by accepting and solving our problems that we can begin to get right with ourselves and with the world about us and with Him who presides over us all. Understanding is the key to right principles and attitudes, and right action is the key to good living. Therefore, the joy of good living is the theme of AA's 12th step. Thanks for letting me share.